Welcome to the Whistleblower Newsroom with Christina Borgeson on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Cancer. It has not been described as the emperor of all maladies for no reason. The National Cancer Institute reported in 2020 that almost 40% of men and women will be diagnosed with cancer during their lifetimes. The American Cancer Society estimated that in the U.S., there would be 1.9 million new cancer cases diagnosed in 2021 and 608,570 cancer deaths. These grim statistics show that far too little progress has been made in addressing this disease. There are reasons why, and my guest today is here to talk about them and about his role as a disruptor of the status quo with his approach to treating and healing cancer. Oncologist Dr. Raymond Chang has top-flight credentials, having received his medical degree with high honors from Brown University, been elected a fellow of the American College of Physicians, and been on staff at the world-renowned Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. He is also trained in Eastern medicine and is known as one of the earliest pioneers in the field of alternative cancer therapies, having founded in 1997 the Meridian Medical Group in New York, an alternative practice focused on complex, serious health issues, including cancers and autoimmune diseases that are not well served by modern Western medicine. Hailed by New York Magazine as a, quote, new healer, unquote, more than 20 years ago, Dr. Chang has spent the past two decades devoting his efforts to calling for a different paradigm for treating cancer using a cocktailed approach, which he describes in his landmark book, Beyond the Magic Bullet, The Anti-Cancer Cocktail, A New Approach to Beating Cancer. Does it work? It did for me. Full disclosure, Dr. Chang is my lead oncologist and has been treating me for kidney cancer, of which I have been recently cleared. Welcome, Raymond.
Pleasure.
When did you get this idea to come up with a cocktail approach and to change your approach to dealing with cancer?
I think it came on gradually. My personal background is, and my undergraduate interest was in philosophy. So I like to think metaphysically sometimes about things and look into the underlying principles and reasons of why we do certain things a certain way we do them. And of course, being of Asian origin, I think some of the ways of thinking is kind of ingrained culturally. I would not say it's like there was a eureka moment, but things came gradually when one becomes dissatisfied with the conventional approach in modern medicine, where things are increasingly protocolized, where bureaucracy dictates practice, and we are also driven by pharmaceutical interests and insurance interests that comes before the patient's interest. But this also, these issues, these negative trends also intensified during the past few decades that I've been in practice. So again, I don't think it's a eureka moment, but gradually it's clearer to me what doesn't seem to be a right approach and what the weak link was that it's not necessarily, so my point is, we're so focused, all the research funding, top scientific minds are focused on finding new and better treatments. But maybe we take a breath, slow down, and think about it. It may not entirely be that we're missing like a top-notch weapon for the war. But maybe we don't have the right strategy. So if you don't have the right strategy, In war, it doesn't matter what kind of weapons you possess. If you have the right strategies, the weaponry may not may be secondary. So, I mean that is well known to certainly military strategists. We have, and this is a very Western way of thinking. We have to believe that the more intense is the better, the more powerful the better. Nuke them all, nuke it all, and the more expensive much must be better. The more recent discoveries must be better than older discoveries, etc. But if you think deeply about these matters, it may not be the case. So, exactly in wars, we've experienced that. It's not always the superpower that wins. I think the focus is my focus is more on strategy, which aligns with my more philosophical background. I'm more interested in the principles of treatment and how we put things together to think about it and not to act in a mindless fashion, just following some treatment protocol. If A, then B, then C. If not C, then D. I mean, that's a very just a what I call a cafeteria approach. If it's Monday, it's chicken soup. That is totally mindless, but unfortunately, that's how medicine is practiced,
Well,
especially at major institutions. They have to follow and abide by protocols. And so frequently they will say, this is protocol. You have stage X cancer of this type, then the protocol treatment is A.
what if the protocol doesn't work?
And you go to B.
And that doesn't work.
And you
I
go,
mean,
which is usually a lesser protocol because ethically they give you the best one up front. So then you call upon the reserve, then it's B. B doesn't work, then you go to C. But it's linear. If you notice, it's one thing after another. It's try penicillin first for your sore throat. That doesn't work. Call me in 3 days. Then we put you on something stronger, amoxicillin. That doesn't work. We switch you to something stronger. Okay, but cancer is not a sore throat. When things don't work, you may be nearer to your deathbed. It's not a sore throat. So you lose time, and when they start a treatment A, they can only give you a statistic that there's a certain chance that this will work, but there's no guarantees. So you may spend a few months trying to figure out if it's working. Unlike a sore throat, it's not like you call the doctor after 3 days. I mean, it will take them a few 3 months to see if the treatment's working. And if
right.
it's not working, then you're on your way down towards the ditch.
Right.
For example, if it's an advanced case, and then you lost 3 months, then you have to try treatment B, which is a lesser treatment by definition because they gave you the better one up front. Then that may not work, and you don't know. Again, you're kind of in the dark, and then you're proceeding in this linear way, one thing after another, because that is protocol. I think then there's a way to improve the odds. It's all about odds, because since we don't know if it's going to be 100% successful, so it's like a bet. It's a betting a situation, like a gambling situation. You place your bets. We know the odds, but there's no guarantee that you'll win. So,
Right.
what's the best way to approach this game, if you think of it that way, or this whole thing? So, there are better ways, more rational, more scientific. There are better ways to give you a better outcome.
I want to break this down piece by piece the way you did in your book, because the first thing that you said that struck me was even the definition of cancer limits the way you think about treatment. You talked about the National Cancer Institute's definition of cancer being diseases in which abnormal cells divide without control and invade other tissues. And so you're looking for something that can stop the unruly division of cells. But
yes.
your idea is that cancer is far more complicated than that.
It's far more complicated in that there are multiple dimensions. Each cancer is different. Each patient is different. People sometimes forget that we as physicians should not be only treating the disease, but ultimately, really, ideally, we should be treating the patient with the disease. It's the person that you are treating, not the disease that you are treating in isolation. Treating COVID is not only about treating it's not treating the virus, it's treating the person with the virus, which can manifest in so many different ways. So same with the cancer, depending on the stage, depending on the histology, the genetics, et cetera, but very much dependent also on the patient. You can have two people with the exact same disease, but with that warrants totally different approach, totally different, night and day.
Why is that?
Because you take the person into account.
So their particular health situation, their metabolism.
Yeah, I give you
metabolism.
Examples of patients I've had. I had a priest from Schenectady with a prostate cancer. When proposed with, which is a standard treatment of medical castration, the use of hormones, which will render him impotent, his reaction was hallelujah. That's a gift of God. I mean, it's fine. I'll go with that anytime. No problem. I start right away. The same disease, the same stage, the same prostate cancer. But I treated a well-known jazz man, trumpet player. He's older than the priest, in his 70s. But he told me he just got married 2 months ago to a young lady. And his answer when I proposed the same treatment for the same disease, remember, his answer, instead of hallelujah, he said, hell no. No way I'm going to do that. Okay. And he also, both of them had good outcomes. Both of them had good outcomes. The jazz player went on into his 90s, actually married again.
Wow.
And, you know, he did not, he died of something totally unrelated, he died of kidney failure, unrelated to his cancer. But so, I mean, that's a stark example.
Did you treat them very differently?
Yes, different because of what their wishes are.
Right.
Because again, you treat the patient, not the cancer. Otherwise, if you go to an institution, since it's the same cancer, they don't care who is harboring the cancer, male, female, whatever you got married, didn't get married, whatever you're a jazz player or a priest, they will be given exactly the same option. What I said is the chicken soup approach, a cafeteria approach, it's the same serving. Okay, but I think that is wrong. We treat the person with the disease. And the person, they may be different, so you should approach it differently. You should take their considerations into account and their situations into account. So then you have totally different treatments.
There are standard treatments that are given to patients. I come from a family that has a lot of cancer. It's always the same. Chemotherapy, radiation, and in
right.
their case, death, okay? And the chemotherapy is so deleterious to their immune system.
Right.
And it's, to me, I feel like chemotherapy is the equivalent of mowing the lawn. You mow the lawn and it looks great, although you do have to have your head in a bucket for a while because it has bad side effects. And then it sprouts up again. And you mentioned in your book that one of the reasons for that is that it does not destroy the stem cells of the cancer.
Yes, that is one problem. It is believed that there are so-called cancer stem cells, which is kind of like the mother root of the evil cell, or really the root. So the usual treatments, which is chemotherapy and radiation, etc., usually does not touch the stem cells. So you can pare everything down. It's kind of like you kill all the bees except the queen. So basically, the cells can repopulate, which this accounts for why there are recurrences, even after extensive treatment, when things looked good for a while and then it only lasts a while and then things come back with a vengeance, because you never got rid of the root of the problem. And so the chemotherapies and radiation therapies, not that it doesn't do anything, it does buy time. It will push back. It will give you a period of window where there's less burden of cancer, but it did not get rid of the seeds. It's like, using your example, it's like you mow the lawn down or whatever, you try to mow the weeds down, but there are, you know, they have shed the seeds. You didn't mow the seeds down.
The other thing it does is it decimates your immune system. And I don't think a treatment can be successful or even delaying it, like giving you time like chemotherapy. If it destroys your immune system, your body can never recover that, it seems. And it seems to me, and you tell me if you've thought about this, I'm sure you have, that the one's natural in immune system, the engagement of the natural immune system in this process of healing cancer is important.
In the past 5-10 years, there is less doubt about the role of the immune system, because the latest treatments in cancer and the hottest area is immunotherapy. But this is new. For the longest time, it was kind of ignored, at least in the way Western medicine developed. Immunotherapy is not a mainstay. Immunotherapy was thought to be like an alternative medicine, or it's not taken seriously until very recently. And it used to be much credit was awarded to chemo and radiation, etc., because it does, it's like your lawnmower, it does do its job. I mean, the lawn does look cleared up afterwards. I mean, the seeds are still there and things come back, and ultimately it's the same issue, but it works, and it works very well for certain cancers. There are cancers that are cured by chemotherapy. No doubt, it's a very small percentage. But
which ones?
Some leukemias can be completely eradicated by chemotherapy, for example. So it's not like, and it is useful. And I'm not against chemo or radiation. It has to be used appropriately. But it used to be that they did not give our own immune system the significance that it deserves until more recent.
I read an article about an English patient who took Keytruda for kidney cancer, and he was completely healed. He responded extremely well, was completely healed. And the article was saying one of the reasons why he was so responsive was because he had not had chemo and radiation before. Chemo and radiation apparently alters the immune system in such a way that...
Yes, of course, yeah.
Let's just move on to your cocktail approach, because part of that approach is using from antidepressants to... antiparasitics, which
exactly.
is one of what you gave me. So could you talk about that?
At the time, we called it off-label medicines. Off-label means it doesn't say on the FDA-approved label that it's intended for the condition that you intend to use it for. So it's off the the official label. So the label has to be approved. The label on the labeling on the drug and the warts are approved by the government. You cannot just simply put there that it treats everything under the sun. So that is not legal. So they can only put what's approved by the government. So if something is not on the label, off label, then it's it belongs to a different legal category. Okay. So now it's called repurposed drugs, which means the same thing, but it's less focused on the label, on the labeling, which is so repurposed drugs, the current name that's most commonly used, refers to medicines that are developed and normally applied to treat one thing that we can use it to treat another thing. And there are lots of medicines like that. In your medicine cabinet, you'll find that aspirin typically is one of these things that on the label, it may say it's good for headaches and fevers, but commonly it's used for preventing heart attacks and strokes. It can even be used to treat a corn on your foot and many other things. So aspirin actually has a lot of other uses.
Apparently anti-cancer too, from your book.
Yes, also it can be used to prevent colon cancer and other cancers, etc. So if your main purpose is using it is in those other ways, it's not going to be on the label and it's considered a repurposed use. There are a lot of old drugs, common drugs, inexpensive drugs that are useful for cancer, but they are not officially sanctioned.
Talk about some of them specifically.
The one that I use a lot is metformin, that I like a lot because it's very minimally, has almost no serious toxicity. It's used by millions of diabetic patients to control their blood sugar. It's an old drug. It dates, it's over half a century old. It comes from nature. It's from the French lilac plant. It has, its main purpose is to control blood sugar or metabolism. It has other off-label uses. It's also used to treat women with polycystic ovary syndrome to help enhance fertility. It's being researched as a longevity drug. It's one of the only drugs that's proven, at least in animals, to prolong life. So, but there's a lot of data on the use of metformin as a treatment and preventative for cancer.
How does it act?
I wrote a paper on this, which is now included in a book chapter, metformin and its and how it works and which cancer it's good for. It's what I call a multifaceted mechanism of action. It has multiple dimensions. It helps the immune system. It blocks blood supply to cancer cells. But the main way that it works is by controlling sugar. Sugar is the fuel for cancer cells. It's like gasoline. Well, now electricity can be a fuel for an automobile. So the idea is if you control the fuel to the cancer can grow, it can accelerate, it cannot spread. So, but there are lots of studies, which the studies started in England when they were surprised to notice that diabetic patients who are taking metformin are less prone to develop cancer. Now, they're surprised because you would think that a diabetic is a weaker person, has more medical issues. If anything, they should have a worse, probability of either developing or dying from cancer. But if you looked, actually, diabetics who take metformin have better probabilities of not contracting, coming down with cancer, or to die from cancer. So that led to more and more work, both in the test tube and then in animals and in cancer by cancer, showing that across the board, metformin reduces the occurrence, may improve the survival, reduce the metastases, et cetera. So it's really It's a very wonderful thing. Well, then how come not everybody is taking it? Well, I'm taking it. I don't have cancer. I'm just taking it as a preventative. Well, that has to do with that it's legally, we're not supposed to prescribe it because it's not FDA sanctioned for anything other than the diabetes. Okay, so you have to do it off-label. It creates a legal liability for the physician. If something goes wrong, you took metformin and for something that goes wrong, whether really related or unrelated, but you go home and something happened to you and oddball side effect and the physician gets summoned to court. First thing first is that they will say that, why did you prescribe this? This is not supposed to be used for this. So that immediately points to some sort of negligence, as if you're not doing the right thing.
You have the legal right as a physician to prescribe it.
You have the right, but in the court of law and in case of medical malpractice, the way these cases are judged and decided is by your peers. So it's your peers professionally say, do they do this? And if they all come up and say, no, none of it, we don't do this. So if you don't follow the what's called a common standard of practice, you're in the wrong. Nothing to do with science. It has to do with what's legally, you're legally vulnerable if you don't practice the way your colleagues practice in your local area.
In your book, you said that a lot of doctors tacitly agree that this cocktail approach using some of these off-label drugs is a good way to address cancer, and yet they won't do it because of what you just said. And to me, that's just
crazy.
Yeah,
you're sticking your neck out because you're doing something that is not sanctioned. I mean, nobody wants to look at, now it's controversial, it's a little extreme case, but the use of ivermectin for COVID. I'm not saying it's not my area. I'm not saying it works or doesn't work. But look at the problems facing some doctors who are trying to prescribe ivermectin. Some of them end up in court. Some
yes.
have to be ordered by a judge. Some hospitals have to be ordered by a judge in order to prescribe, to allow the patient to take ivermectin. But why? I mean, if you're dying, if you're in the throes of the COVID and you're dying and nothing seems to work, ivermectin is such a harmless drug, so inexpensive, et cetera, et cetera. Why not give it to the patient? Well, it's because it's not FDA approved. You can only receive FDA approved substances. Otherwise, you are not practicing by the rule of law.
And
creates liability, and the hospitals don't want it because they don't want the liability. It goes back to liability. It goes back to many other social and economic factors and bureaucratic factors that have to do with the government.
Well,
and it's state by state. Some states it's very difficult. Some states are more liberal in this regard. Some states you can. It's almost like abortion. Now you can do it here, you can't do it there, etc. So it can be a very controversial issue.
Here's the thing that really is to me just, it's almost criminal, you know. I mean, as someone who has had cancer and been in that desperate position, I can tell you, I'm looking in your book, you list a whole rafter of these cheap, drugs, everything aspirin lowers risk of colorectal cancer by 20% or more if taken for 5 years, antidepressants killing brain cancer cells, cimetidine acid reducer for treating ulcers is good for kidney, stomach, liver.
Need a prescription, it's over the counter.
And then antibiotics like clarithromycin for multiple myeloma, anticoagulants like heparin reduces cancer's ability of cancer cells to stick together to form tumors, antifungal drugs for prostate cancer, anti-seizure drugs for leukemia and solid tumors. It goes on and on and on. Here's the part that makes me crazy, because you can't get clinical trials on the use of these things for cancers because they're off patent. They're cheap drugs, and it's too expensive to do. It's too expensive to do the clinical trials because these drugs are too cheap and to recoup, I don't know, to recoup the expense. Well, I don't know. You talk to me about this. I mean, this to me
Okay,
is
so
infuriating.
it's very simple. The finance, just to take just to have a few numbers in mind. If you simply Google the cost of drug discovery, a new drug is now costing $1 to $1.3 billion to come to market. Come to market means
Just
go through the
crazy.
trials, get approved by the FDA. And the timeline is close to 10 years for a drug. From discovering it in the lab, testing it in animals, then in humans, then going through the FDA, and then to be licensed, and finally to be covered by insurance payers. It's a decade-long process that's costing currently $1 to $1.3 billion, and it's going up every year. So if you have a very cheap medicine like metformin, which is in the pennies, cimetidine, which is even brand name cimetidine, you get over the counter at CVS for a couple of dollars, a package. So yeah, aspirin, we don't even have to say, okay, it's $3 for a bottle of 100. So which company in its right mind would try to spend hundreds of millions or millions even, putting a medicine that they don't own because everybody can make it. It's off patent, as you say. Why would any sane pharmaceutical executive try to put this through clinical trials to prove that it works in order to do what? Normally, drug companies do trials to prove that something works in order to be able to market and distribute and sell it. Remember, pharmaceutical companies are not charities. They are for-profit corporations, no different from McDonald's or Johnson and Johnson, for example. It's no different. They are not charities. It's not the Doctors Without Borders or American Red Cross. They are not there to develop drugs to benefit humankind. But they are there. Well, if it benefits humankind, all the better. But they also have a duty to their shareholders to make money for them. That is the issue. So a money losing proposition is to try to spend millions on trying to prove that something works for cancer, and then to have other companies make and compete with you at much lower cost because they did not do the study. Remember, everybody can make these drugs, Indian company, Chinese company, etc. They are generic. It's the same issue with some of these generic drugs that work for COVID. Nobody wants to develop them or to study them too much because, heck, there's no profit.
I just had this idea talking to you. They should declare cancer a pandemic and issue EUAs for all of those drugs, emergency use authorization for all of these drugs. The other thing I think is that physicians like you, who are successfully treating patients, should aggregate the data from all your the patients that you have treated, aggregate that and put it in a world database and let that be the peer, put that in peer-reviewed.
It's a good idea, but it will be criticized at the methodologic level because there is no conformity or uniformity of the patients. Some are older, some are younger. So They're all over the place. So
But
clinical
that's
trials.
the whole point. That's the
No,
point.
but no, but you see, this is the other issue. This is the limitations of the scientific method, which now the clinical trial is sacrosanct. They pick and choose patients that are uniform, the same stage of cancer, the same, approximately this age group. They all have, and plus everybody is given only one thing at one time to see how that one thing works, because the idea is to study that one thing. Now, none of my patients only doing one thing. Even if they're taking one drug, they may be on a special diet, et cetera, et cetera. So you cannot compare apples and oranges. We know that. And if you put it out there, you'll be criticized for mixing things up. Now, how do you know it's not because certain patients that see you may be doing five other things on their own? I mean, they're not so-called, it's not a clean set, which if you put it out there will be shot down by the academics, that they say that doesn't represent
Well,
anything. It's the patients who went to Chang just had good luck. I mean, like you. So they say it's good luck. How can you prove that it's
well,
statistically not relevant?
that makes no sense because here's where the rubber meets the road. The rubber meets the road where the patient, where you look at the patient, is the patient healthy? Is the patient healed? Is it, and you do case after case after case after case after case of that. And also the fact that when you were talking about, these clinical trials, they try one thing and one thing alone. So they will never, under this paradigm, they will never achieve a drug that will cure a cancer patient, that will literally cure a cancer. And I'm going to tell you something, Raymond. The thing that struck me the most about you when I first walked into your office was that you said something to the effect, I'll never forget it. You said, I'm not just here to treat you, I'm here to heal you. I had never heard a physician say that to me, ever. And now you've put your finger on something, a paradigm that will never, ever achieve a healing result. Because A, it's not even defining the diseases in a way. It defines the diseases in a limited way, which then limit and they research the disease in a limited way. And so they will never ever and yet and more people have cancer. A lot of people die, lots of people, like 1.2, if you have 609,000 whatever people out of almost 2 million, that's a lot of people.
You pinpoint it. I mean, it's difficult. So you have a good point when you say we should declare this a pandemic. I didn't think of that. But when things are cancer is now frequently touted as a chronic disease, which is euphemistic at its best, because no, it's not chronic disease. Come on. But doctors are now younger doctors sometimes are coached to use that to sugarcoat the diagnosis when they talk to the patient. Oh, you have a chronic disease, so don't worry. But cancer's not high blood pressure. Who are you kidding, right? So, but then if it's looked at as well, it's something we deal with. You can live with it. Live with cancer, etc. So, it's the cure is not in the mind, and there's lack of urgency. There are not so many advocate groups, and they are not as urgent, okay?
I
There's
don't
no.
understand that. Everybody either has cancer or has someone in their family who has.
Right, but there is no sense of urgency. Every other person has high blood pressure and high cholesterol also, but those are treated like, hey, heck, that's what you get. That's what you get, and it's a chronic, then it's a chronic problem. But for example, then we look back to when HIV, you recall the time. When
Yep.
HIV first landed into our consciousness and our practice that there is such a disease, it was urgent. And there are groups of patients who were very activist, the HIV patients, okay, they actually went to protest down in Washington in front of the FDA. Say, we need a treatment cure now. We can't wait. We're dying. We don't, you know, no cancer patients going down to the FDA to protest. Okay. And that did spur action. That actually led to Dr. David Holmes coming up with cocktail treatment for HIV, which is now standard for HIV. All HIV patients are treated with cocktails. The drugs are made as cocktails. Each drug has, well, it's one pill, but it could have three things in it, for example. So, but what prompted that was the urgency and the political activism, because patients were young at the time. A lot of them were young people. And you know, I mean, it's HIV was is the sentence is same as cancer. I mean, you die from a horrible disease, but since it's a new disease and affected young people, there was activism, which did lead to these that you jump through, you know, you were able to get things done that would otherwise not be done. We are somewhat laid back with cancer. Think about it.
Well, I
Numbers are
think part of the
wonderful. There's a lot
reason.
of money. There's all they say, and there is treatment already. You know, it's they're not perfect, but there are treatments. So nobody says that there's nothing to treat you with. It's just not very good things to treat you
I
with.
noticed that the doctor who wrote the foreword to your book was diagnosed with glioblastoma and was told, you got a
Yeah,
couple of
Dr.
months
William.
go to, and he treated himself using a cocktail approach, and he healed
He's cured.
himself. He's cured. And I know my personal experience. I have one sister who died of glioblastoma. Horrible, horrible death, horrible death. Two died of ovarian cancer. Again, horrible deaths after chemo and radiation. I mean, they lived the last few years of their lives literally, in bed or vomiting or what. It was horrible. I mean, I took care of them myself. And when I came down with cancer, I just said to myself, forget it. I prefer to die a quick death than have my head in a bucket for years or be laid out in lavender in my bed, and living, existing in my bed. And so, fortunately, I'm an investigative reporter and I was doing a lot of research and so on, and I was questioning my doctors and so on, and I finally found you literally to me almost at the last minute, I think. But I never, ever, ever had that experience of being debilitated, ever, ever. And I was on this, and I'm still on this cocktail of drugs that you prescribed to me, including, by the way, an antiparasitic, which I'm very interested in. What is it that antiparasitics do?
Okay, that's a very interesting question to me also. And I wrote a paper on the use of anti-malarials for cancer. And what we did was we surveyed all existing anti-malarials, all the drugs that are considered that used for malaria in the world. And of all of them, a very great percentage of them, if you also tested them in the lab against cancers, a high percentage of them work against cancers. Now you would say
How?
that's a coincidence. I mean, you can you imagine the screening a high blood pressure medicines and you know that you'll find a lot of them will work for cancer. So that the next question is what similarity between a parasite, which is malaria, the parasite, and a parasite and cancer? That's very interesting. I'm not saying cancer is a parasite, but think about it. There are a lot of parallels. A parasite feeds upon you, it exists in you, grows within you, and may eventually at least not demolish you necessarily, but certainly weaken you to a certain extent and can kill you. But so it has similar attributes to a parasite. And there are people who used to think of cancer as a parasite. It is parasitic. It feeds upon your healthy body to its own advantage. It
Right.
takes, you know, it saps you in order for itself to gain. So that's very interesting. So, but It's just, could it be just a coincidence? But there are a lot of molecular mechanisms that are shared. So it turns out that a lot of anti-malarials, which are anti-parasitics, so such as chloroquine, which is the controversial drug that we had for COVID also. But chloroquine is actually a very safe drug, dirt cheap, again, dirt cheap. Which has been shown to be useful in a lot of cancers. Brain cancer, glioblastoma. There's trials done. There was trials clinically, they're controlled, randomized controlled trials. Glioblastoma patients doing standard treatment and standard treatment plus additional chloroquine. The people who took chloroquine survived much better than those who only did standard. Now, chloroquine is so inexpensive, but
How did
that's
it
just
work, though? How did it, what did it do
it
exactly?
induces what we call autophagy. It's a self it's kind of it causes the cells to self-destruct.
Oh,
So
okay.
now you can think, as I said, so what's the difference between then and chemo, which also destroys? Chemo destroys from the outside, what I would call like homicide, is a murder. Okay, but some of these medicines, like chloroquine, causes the cells to self-destruct, which is suicide. So the end result is the same. Homicide and suicide both lead to death, but I'm sure everybody will agree that homicide and suicide is not the same thing.
Right.
It leads to the same thing. It's death, but death by other and death by self is not the same thing.
Well, also,
So
it
it
does
has
it with
this.
less toxicity too, right?
Yes, it's hardly toxic, et cetera. So, but we came back to the come back to the same question. The issue is no pharmaceutical company is going to spend the funding to put it into clinical trial. It's too cheap. So if you prove that it works and everybody starts taking chloroquine, who is to gain? The patients,
The
sure.
patient.
Yeah, but that's of least concern. But none of the pharmaceutical companies have anything to gain.
Well, then, do
That
you
is the
think this
problem.
is something that
The
the
payer is
government?
supposed to put up the money to do it. So they're doing it, what, for benevolent reasons only?
What about the government institutions that fund med?
The government, like NCI, I don't want to speak for the NCI, but it has a fundamental mission to discover new drugs. And actually, part of it is that, again, I'm not working for the NCI, et cetera. So they are partial to drugs that can be patentable and that will be commercialized. Imagine the government coming up with some medicine that works. Now, government is not in the pharmaceutical business of distributing drugs. The government can come up with a new drug. It will then license it to, even for free, they will give it or license it to a drug company with the understanding that the drug company will try to commercialize and distribute it. If something does not have that potential, the government will not invest efforts into exploring it because that is not the job of the government. What's the point of coming up with a medicine that nobody's going to make? There's no point. That's
I
the
mean,
argument. Why would
okay.
you research and find something that nobody will produce? Then it's a dead end, right? So they are preferably trying to come up with new compounds, new molecules, something entirely new that can be patented. The patents last for 20 years, and then a drug company will take it on to develop it into a pharmaceutical. The drug company will do the trials, et cetera. The government will come up with it. So that's the usual way things work.
It's absurd. It's absurd
Yeah.
because the government is supposed to serve the people. It uses the people's tax dollars, and it's using the people's tax dollars essentially almost against them in this case, because if
We are in this, we are captivated by the capitalist system.
yeah.
What are we, what, you know, this is the system we're in. If this was a different system, it could be slightly different than the government manufactures drugs. Okay, then the government will take the health care of its citizens entirely into its hands, research new drugs, all drugs, do the studies, trials, as well as manufacture and distribute them, and through government hospitals, and there'll be government employed doctors, et cetera. We're not in that kind of a society. Everything is private and driven. Unfortunately, our healthcare system is much driven, if not driven, then controlled, certainly by capitalist instincts. Insurance companies for profit. I mean,
No,
drug companies are for profit. They are listed on the stock
no,
exchange.
no. We know this.
There's no non-profit drug company. There's no non-profit, So, they first look at the bottom line.
Well, maybe there should be
Why spend money
nonprofit.
on chloroquine? I mean, or any of these things, because what's the point? There's no point.
Let's talk about the other parts of the cocktail. You talked about herbs, you talked about just talk about the other parts of it.
There are standard drugs and there are non-standard drugs, which are so-called off-label, repurposed, etc. Then there are supplements, vitamins, and herbs. What is a supplement and what is a drug is somewhat artificial because some supplements in this country is considered a supplement that you can get at a health food store, but in another country would be considered a drug. For example, melatonin, that is common here, you will need a prescription for if you went to Europe, for example.
What does it do?
There are lots of studies and lots of patients using it. It also affects the immune system. Professor Lissoni from Italy has done a lot of studies on the use of melatonin, for example.
You talk about vitamin D being very important.
Yes, we've been saying for decades, actually. So vitamin D3 is very useful. It is formally used as a prescription version of it. That's a 50,000, comes in 50,000 units a pill that's taken weekly as a treatment, as a prescribed treatment on prescription. And then, of course, you can get just in a supplement store vitamin D. It is good
Right.
for prevention. I take it myself again. And I think there's a rampant, very common, let's say, not necessarily rampant, but deficiency of vitamin D because people avoid the sun. A lot of people avoid the sun thinking that it causes cancer. So you're always told to wear, okay, if you're out in the sun, you should wear sunscreen. Then that actually leads to a deficiency of vitamin D,
Which can cause cancer
which can
tumor.
be, well, think about it. That's actually very interesting. Vitamin D, I mean, we're quite smart creatures, or God created us in a very smart way. In response to the sun, to the ultraviolet rays that hit our skin and which can cause cancer, we produce vitamin D in the skin that counteracts that. That's not so hard to understand. We make something that counteracts something, but we make it naturally, to protect ourselves against some damaging, rays from nature. We naturally produce this, except that we're now trying to protect against the rays, and so we don't produce it. So you become deficient, and then internally you can have cancers as well. Okay, but anyway, that's another story. So
So
our bodies can be quite smart.
I think the immune system
I mean,
is
yeah, we.
genius if we just supported it more, you know. I mean,
Yeah.
there are two things, there are two other things I want to talk to you about. One is the Chinese medicine.
Chinese herbal medicine, of course, has a very long tradition. It is not primarily developed against cancers for a very simple reason. Cancer is not such a common disease. If you go back in time and in ancient China, either people didn't live long enough usually to get it, and there aren't so many carcinogens in the environment that will give you cancer. So it's not the prominent feature of traditional Chinese medicine to treat cancers. However, there are many, many useful natural substances from herbs to minerals. Chinese medicine is not just herbs, only traditional Chinese herbs, but it's herbs and animals and insects and minerals and everything from nature, which can include all these things. There are modern drugs that are developed from traditional Chinese plant material or herbs or herbal material. For example, arsenic trioxide is now, it's called Tricinox. It is a drug that's now used to treat acute leukemias. That is derived from a Chinese herbal formula, is where it came from. It used to be called Chairman Mao's treatment for cancer. And also artemisinin or artensinate, yes, which is a natural anti-malarial, for which the discoverer, the Chinese researcher, Dr. Tu, Professor Tu, got the Nobel Prize just a few years ago for medicine. She's the first Chinese researcher to get the Nobel Prize for medicine from China. So she discovered this anti-malarial, which turns out it's also a good anti-cancer. So there are Chinese herbs from which cancer treatments can be discovered from. And of course, you can also use Chinese herbs in the traditional way to give the herbal, the brew to the patient, et cetera. The problem is, again, the lack of studies. Whereas it's easy to test one herb in a test tube against some cancer cells, but to organize large studies, giving people, say, 100 people with lung cancer only take this herbal brew versus another 100 doing chemo, this kind of study will not be done.
Well, not only that, but oftentimes you have different herbs that you take at different times of the day.
If you do it properly, you're supposed to personalize the herbal formula for the patient, and it should constantly change. It changes with the season, changes with the patient. I mean, we change the formulas because the person changes over time. You know, so it's constantly being manipulated and moved around to rhyme with the patient, okay? To rhyme with the condition of the patient. So it's a dynamic treatment,
right?
Which you cannot do a clinical trial, because then, you know, they will argue that, well, it's not the same, you know, it's day one, you're getting this, day seven, you're getting that, and, you know. So it's quite impossible to do. So that's the problem. Again, the criticism is the lack of data. Lack of data is the problem.
The problem is that the data is actually in the treatment. It's in the patients that have been successfully treated. And that leads me to something that I find still very, very shocking about the Western medical system, which is how there is absolutely zero training on nutrition. Zero.
Yes.
Zero training. Important. And nutrition for cancer is extremely important.
That is also true. Most patients who die from cancer actually die from malnutrition. That is not addressed. It's not well known. Food is disparaged. Partly, again, there's a commercial reason. There is no big company making special. If there was one company specialized in only making foods for cancer patients, then there will be a lot of marketing, promotions, studies, trials, and they would have reps going to doctors' offices telling the doctor, tell the patient to eat this, eat that. Food is looked down upon. I hear lots of stories from patients who said they went to their doctor at the cancer center and they asked the doctor, what should I eat? And the doctor simply says, eat what you like to eat.
Yes. So, I've had that experience.
Or they refer you, okay, then talk to the dietitian. And the dietitian will give you a spiel about the eat the five servings of fruits and vegetables a day. And that's it. So it's what I call it. It's a Mickey Mouse level. And the doctor's training, the medical school, usually has a 2-week module on nutrition as part of their first year medical school or second year medical school. And that's it. So, there's very little, unless the doctor himself is interested, there's very little education and awareness on the usefulness and the impact of diets for cancer. And the other thing is, of course, if you think that a certain diet is useful, ideally you organize a clinical trial. But again, who's going to pay for it?
We've reached the end of our time, but I want to tell you how deeply grateful I personally am to you for your work. But I feel that millions of people around the world, if they knew about you and your work, would also be equally grateful. So keep it up and let's see if we can get the
Thank
word
you for
out.
those very kind words.